Welcome to the Todd and Noah Show, taking the mystery out of electric motors. Well, Noah, welcome once again. We've got Noah Bethel, our Vice President of Product Development.
Hello from sunny Tampa, Florida.
And I'm Todd Gunderson, the Vice President of Sales and Marketing. We're taking the mystery out of electric motors. You call it smoke sometimes, or...
Well, we want to keep the smoke in.
We want to keep the smoke in. On the ride over, we were listening to some old classic radio, Bob Hope on the radio, Suspense. He was a bad lawyer, wasn't he?
I wonder how many of our listeners know Bob Hope.
Well, let's hope it's not just us. let's hope it's more than that. So how have you been? Are you healthy, wealthy, wise?
Well, maybe a few of those. I don't think all.
Well, like we say, two out of three ain't bad.
Yes.
I think they wrote a song about that.
I've heard that song, actually.
it was a Meatloaf song. Rest in peace, remember? I want you, I need you, but there ain't no way I'm ever going to
That's the one.
You. All right, so welcome back. We've got a great topic, this podcast, Rotor.
You know, I think it's a crowd favorite, and the reason I think it's a crowd favorite is because it's actually... sort of a tangible part of a motor, it's actually moving, right? When a lot of people, you know, think about, you know, motors kind of magical, right? How come it turns on? Well, these invisible magnetic fields in the stator, right? But the rotor's moving, and so it seems like people can relate to it better.
It's a crowd favorite.
I like the crowd favorite.
Yeah, it makes us sound like we're somebody. Rotor's a crowd favorite. Well, we developed these six fault zones, and we've already gone through four of the fault zones, power circuit, power quality, insulation, stator.
Yep.
And now we're going into rotor, which is the rotating portion of the asset.
Absolutely.
So, Noah, if you could just give us some things that can go wrong with the rotor.
Well, there's a variety. You know, what's interesting, there's a study years ago. It was funded by EPRI. Actually, and GE did the study on primarily utility motors, right? And they blamed 10% of motor failures on the rotor.
Okay.
So we'll keep that in mind as we go through the fault zone, and we'll try to relate that. Because there are a lot of things that can go wrong with the rotor. I'd like to see them study that again in today's, with the designs of today, and see how, you know, with more technology available to identify the faults. But the numero uno is cracked or broken bars, right? So if you think of this, and we're going to be focusing a lot on a squirrel cage induction rotor, which is basically, again, steel laminations on the rotor with rotor bars of aluminum or copper design running through it and then shorted at the end ring. But, you know, that being said, if any one of those bars crack, that's a big deal. Right, it causes a significant change in the way the magnetics are formed around that bar. So we're going to focus a lot on that. Porosity is another one, and again, that focuses us more on the cast aluminum. Okay, as far as when you instead of actually forging a bar and laying it into the slot, we can cast rotors as well and fill those rotor slots up with a casting of aluminum.
So, but now going back to the cracked rotor bar, I've often gone into motor shops, and when they pull the rotor out, and the pictures that have come to us to develop case studies, sharing customer stories about broken rotor bars, you always see that they're broken kind of at the same location. It's not like you have one on the top of the rotor and then 180 degrees down below there's another crack.
Right.
They're very, they
little
run
groups of failures.
Yeah, groups of failures.
Yes, absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, and it's very easy to explain. So, like, if you have one of the things that people don't realize is when you start a motor, especially across the line, there are so much current flowing through that rotor on startup, okay? And the thermal expansion is extreme, right? So, if you have 24 bars, if all 24 bars are thermally expanding axially at the same rate, no problem. Mm-hmm. What if you have one with a crack or a high resistance connection? Well, it's not going to have as much current flowing through it.
Because it's not conducting.
It's not conducting as much, right? So as a result, the other bars are expanding at a higher rate. We call that a differential thermal expansion, tensile stress, and it causes a crack. Well, when that also happens, the broken bar or the bars next to the broken bar have to work a little bit overtime in an effort to make up for the
load
loss.
Because the load doesn't change.
Load does not give up, right?
It's there.
So it says, well, let's send more... you know, heat and thermal expansion through the bars next to it. Well, what ends up happening is you know, every next bar ends up expanding differently and at a thermal differential. And as a result, they crack, the next one cracks next to it and next to it and next to it. So they tend to occur in patches as a result of one affecting the other. But it's a great, okay, great study. A lot of times they'll mark them with a yellow pin or something. We call it the yellow line disease.
So I've also heard of defective rotor iron. What does that mean?
So it's kind of similar to our standard fault zone of before. You know, if the rotor bars are perfect, the end rings are perfect, but the laminations that these bars are laid into are shorting, okay, because they're supposed to be insulated from each other. Okay, each little small sliver of lamination pressed together with the spider ring, those are basically insulated from each other. But if they stop being insulated for some reason due to, let's say, overheating or rotor stator rub or something happens, then we get eddy currents or, you know, losses in the rotor, which causes localized heating, inefficiency, and some problems. So lamination damage is absolutely considered, you know, one of the failure mechanisms for the rotor.
And that, we would call that either defective iron or lamination damage as well?
It's all the same, right? So those laminations made with a carbonized steel, they're very high quality steel. And again, they're there to increase the permeability, to help magnetic fields flow easily. But at the same time, they shouldn't be conducting current between each other.
I don't think, this is why we've often, going back to our introduction, develop a relationship with your motor shop, right?
Absolutely.
So that you can see an actual rotor in the shop to see all those tiny little laminations. Most people don't understand that they're insulated from each other.
Absolutely. You know, a good challenge we like to give to our customers is, if you have not been to your motor shop to see a breakdown, get there. We're not saying you should expect your name over
there.
A door or anything.
Yeah, you don't
right?
have to live there, but
unless you spend a lot of money there, right? But get there. See that even us in the reliability industry, in the motor industry, we learn something every time we walk into a motor shop.
Yeah.
And so it's a very good thing to practice to do on a regular basis.
Well, the old adage, you try to learn something every day. You learn something new every day. It's no different than, like, if you're a homeowner, you do the same thing. If somebody's got to come and look at your AC unit, well, I like to walk around with the guy just to see what he's looking at, see what are the parameters that he's looking at, what should they be versus what are they, and how are they collecting that information, or somebody, whatever, plumber comes into your house,
right.
Let's see what he's doing, yeah. How is he doing that, so that maybe you can take some of that information and use it
next time.
Or impart it to your next generation.
Absolutely.
Right, so getting back to rotors, testing motors in the field, what types of tests should we do in the field?
Well, if you haven't heard me talk before, one of my favorite recommendations is the inrush
test. Let me say, let me guess. Wait, is it the standard test?
It's
stupid.
It's the all-famous inrush startup test.
It's the inrush startup test.
Tell all.
Please, Noah, tell us what the inrush startup test is. That your favorite?
It is my favorite. And, you know, I always tell people if I could only have one test of all the tests that are performed by a technology, I would take the inrush startup test. And here, and it's so good related to the rotor fault zone, and here's why. When you start a motor, the most stressful time on that motor's life, and no less the rotor than any other part, is
why is it stressful? Because it's seven times?
It's seeing seven to ten times the current. We're seeing the maximum slip on the rotor, the maximum current flowing through the rotor. Again, once it gets up to speed and the slip reduces, which is the differential RPM between the stator and the rotor, well, now we don't have as much, you know, induction into the rotor. We don't have as much current. The frequency is very low. But, man, when it starts up, very stressful. In fact, a lot of people don't know this, but you might be seeing, you know, many tons of axial pressure in the axial thermal expansion of the rotor. So it's a big, big deal. That inrush startup test, you know, it can tell us a lot. So that's one of the ones we really like focusing on. A little bit of intel on what we see out of that is that, you know, if the rotor is developing problems, it's going to reflect a higher impedance onto the stator, and it's going to actually reduce the amount of current that the stator draws. So what's proportional to current? Torque. So if you have a reduced current, you have a reduced torque, it all kind of goes along with it.
You know, and you bring up a good point. When doing an inrush, you want a tremendous amount of load on that asset. You want to see how it responds. Kind of like if you let's say you're going into the hospital to check your heart out, what are they going to do? You're not going to eat a bunch of yoo-hoos and ding-dongs, are you? They're going to put you on a treadmill, 15-degree level, and put you to a 5 and say, okay, go. Let's see how your heart handles this.
It's a better stress test, for sure.
It's a better stress test than the...
I
like ding-dongs. Who doesn't like it?
Seems like a better choice to me.
Ho-hos. What else? What else can we look at here, Noah?
Get so back the to all Rumor. Classic, which everyone kind of relates to, is current signature analysis.
Okay.
It's still a good tool. You know, it, again, like you mentioned, current signature analysis is probably better off, you know, with a little bit of load. However, we always recommend taking it no matter which load you're on. But the current signature analysis is basically looking at pole pass frequency relationships. So as the rotor is turning slower than the rotating stator magnetic field, that's where induction occurs, and that differential rotation modulates the signal and creates what we call a pole pass frequency. So that's kind of what we're looking at in terms of that motor current signature analysis. And then if you take it one step further, you can actually, you know, demodulate part of that signal and get rid of the line frequency, and we call that a demodulation spectrum. And that takes another look at rotors as well.
And then I've heard, like, speed, we could trend speed maybe?
Right. I love that as we jokingly call it a poor man's tool, right? Because without technology, if you can at least identify speed, well, what would you expect to happen? Well, one of the things that's interesting is with speed changes, you need to understand why. If it's a load-driven speed change, that makes sense. But if you're at the same load and the motor's turning slower, that is an absolute telltale sign of a rotor anomaly. And the reason that occurs is that you mentioned earlier, the load torque demand doesn't change. Just because you have a defective motor doesn't mean the load's going to say, oh, I'm going to feel sorry for the motor and reduce the load. That does not happen. It says, I need 1,000 horse, you're going to give me 1,000 horse. Well, for a motor with a defective rotor to deliver 1,000 horse, it has to reduce the speed, which brings it up in that speed torque curve and allows it to deliver the same amount of torque. So speed's a great indicator.
Yeah, and going back to your inrush startup, which I know is your favorite test, current oscillations is what you look for. And you know the best part about it is you can take that inrush test and the motor can be running. It doesn't have to be at the inrush.
Right. In fact, if the motor's already running, and it's still a great tool because what it does is an RMS envelope of the current, which is basically a direct indication of the torsional loads on the motor. Well, you know, you should at some point have a baseline. You know what the normal torsional loads are. So that RMS envelope, we call it a process analysis, you know, tool. It modulates at a certain percentage, but if that deviation doubles or triples, well, now you have an indication that at normal load, we're seeing some variations that are not machine driven.
So what about offline? Let's say the motor's not operational. What can we look at offline?
Right. So one of the things we've talked a lot about in many fault zones is the inductance measurement. And we're going to talk about it here as well. It's an AC test sent through the stator windings, but the rotor and the stator work very close together. We've mentioned it, like this transformer, you know, sort of relationship where the stator is the primary and the rotor is the secondary. Things going wrong with the rotor are in fact reflected onto the stator. So with the inductance measurement of the stator windings, if you manipulate that rotor field, even in an offline situation, when you shut it down, there's still a residual left on that rotor, and that has a tendency to affect the stator inductance. If that inductance changes, there needs to be a reason why. And what's interesting is the inductance actually goes up of the stator.
Right. So when we were looking at the stator podcast, we were talking about turn squared was the dominant factor when we would see a change in inductance.
Right.
But when we're talking about the rotor, we're really looking at permeability, are we not? Isn't
we
that
are.
The factor in the equation that
Absolutely.
Changes?
Absolutely, because with the rotor fields combining with the stator fields, you are manipulating the permeability of that region, right? And so as you have rotor defaults develop, you're certainly going to influence that stator inductance and that stator permeability. So the inductance value is going to be, you know, a direct indication of changes to the rotor.
In the permeability.
Absolutely.
And so the RIC that we would do, how would that, we like I said, the rotor influence check is very defined for what a stator would look like and what a rotor would look like. On a rotor influence check for a rotor anomaly, we would expect that anomaly, and I've heard you say it like this, that if you have, say, 3 bars and 1 bar is cracked in the middle, and it's not, it acts as a sink now, right?
It does.
It does.
Right.
So that field does not collapse.
Exactly. So in a normal offline environment, when you shut that motor down, the steel itself, right, we talk about the laminations on mm-hmm. the rotor, that's the ferrous material that stores a magnetic field.
Stores a magnetic field.
That magnetic field, just like putting a paperclip across a north and south magnetic pole, it'll collapse that magnetic field, right? So it's not as strong anymore. It's like shorting out a magnetic field. The normal cage of rotors and end rings, collapses, as you mentioned, that magnetic field. But when you break a bar, all of a sudden that steel around that bar is allowed to expand that magnetic field, And that's where we start to change the permeability and the inductance measurement of the stator.
So it changes that graphical look at the rotor.
Taking it one step further, right, when we rotate the rotor at given increments, now you get to see an actual visual, a graphic image of what does that field look like and how is it affecting the stator windings.
And you had said motors are two-pole, four-pole. There's a number of poles inside of a motor depending on what type of speed that you want that motor to be. But let's say a four-pole motor at 1,700 RPM, you would expect that that anomaly would interact with each phase almost identical as it went through it. Because we apply the field to the stator, and it's right. A controlled field, 1,200 hertz.
Exactly.
And we would expect to see this anomaly between the two interactions of the fields.
For those who listen to the Stator Fault Zone podcast, we talked about the A, B, and C of the stator being differently affected if the stator develops a fault. So A might be higher or lower than B and C. But when you're talking about a rotor anomaly, it definitely changes the characteristics of the magnetic field. So you got this variation on the rotor that's abnormal. But when it passes under A, passes under B, passes under C, just like you said, it actually affects all three phases the same. It's another, bit of information that we look at when we're trying to solidify stator versus rotor.
So let's say this was out in the field that we can do this offline, online. What if the motor's back at the shop now that they pulled it out? How can the motor shop do their testing and confirm what's going on?
So motor shops, again, have this advantage of taking things apart, right? So when they start to, they remove
kind
the rotor.
Visually look at
oh,
it for
big
one.
Time. Yeah, because you'll see them, they'll be tapping the rotor with a hammer, listening for different sounds. It's kind of a neat little test. It's not really a foolproof test, but it's for some of these seasoned veterans at the motor shop, they can
kind of like
a lot.
On your wall looking for a stud, huh?
Exactly. You know, they got some amazing tools for that today.
Do
but,
they?
Yeah, we need to go to Home Depot. It's really something.
Let's do this.
Let's do this. That's right. I
got
love
many
that.
Of those buckets at home.
Ah, yes. Amen to that. So, yes, in a shop, when they take things apart, one of the most, you hear a growler test is a very common phrase. And what they do is they basically take this growler, which is basically a magnet, an electromagnet, and they place it on the rotor, and it induces fields into the rotor itself. And then what they'll end up doing with that growler is they can put a saw blade, over the bar. And if that saw blade does not vibrate, or vibrates very differently than the other saw blades, then it's pointing a problem. It's a little bit of a magic kind of test. It's like, what do you mean saw blade? Well, if you take a hacksaw blade and you put it over a bar that's just conducting current straight through, it's an AC current, right? So it's going to be a certain buzz. But if you break that bar, now you're inverting the positive and negative signal significantly differently. All of a sudden, that saw blade starts to buzz very differently and much more dominant. So it's an old school test, but it's still out there. Now, with that same growler, we like to mix it with a mag particle test. So now you got a piece of paper, basically, with floating magnetic particles inside it.
An Etch-a-Sketch.
It's like an Etch-a-Sketch. It's a great analogy. So you energize this rotor with this growler. It's got current flowing through a good bar. Guess what those little magnetic particles do? They line up on that bar. So you got a nice dark line through the location. But guess what happens when you have a bad bar? Well, they don't line up because there's no alignment in the magnetic field. So you got a black line, nothing, and then black line, black line, black line. It's very simple test, very visual. We like that part of it. That's a pretty big deal. And again, as we have always said, if you've got the yellow line drawn on your rotor, it's the yellow bar disease.
Kiss of death.
And you don't want that. Right.
What about quarter voltage tests? I've heard about that. How do you do that?
A quarter voltage test, I really like that, and it can actually be done in the field as well.
Okay.
So, what you do basically, let's say for a 460 volt motor, one quarter, that's 120, just happens to be what comes out of the side of your wall, right? So applying a 120 volt signal directly into a single phase of the stator, right? So you got three phases. If you go from A to B with this 120 volt signal, it's still going to induce a signal into the rotor. Well, now you clamp an ammeter over this 120 volt signal source, and you measure the current. With that, let's say you get X value of current. Then you start rotating the rotor slowly. Well, as long as the bars are healthy, you'd expect a very small variation, from bar to iron to bar to iron to bar to iron as you're turning it. But in the event you have a broken bar, that current changes dramatically. So, and keep in mind, you're only on one phase, right? So as you're turning that, and that broken bar goes underneath that phase magnetic field from the stator, which we've just energized, well, that current will change. More than 5% variation in that current signal indicates a potential problem with the rotor.
Okay. So thank you for that. You were able to give us kind of what can go wrong with the rotor, cracked bars, porosity. You were able to go through the tests offline and online, rotor influence check, motor current signature analysis, inrush startup, of course. How do we not put that first?
Numero uno.
Number one test. And then went through the tests that you can do in the shop itself with the magnetic particle discharge or magnetic particle test. Quarter voltage test, you said you can do that out in the field. A growler test. Now, let's put all that to the test here when we go through. I want to have you kind of guide us through a case study.
Excellent.
On the rotor fault zone. And this sounds ominous because it's designed to, this motor application is designed in a mining operation, but it's a couple miles below the Earth's surface, so it's got to reduce the water table so that you can get at the minerals. So it's a relatively critical motor.
Water in a mine sounds very scary.
Sounds scary. I don't think if it fails, you just can't. I don't think it's a, oh my God, get out.
Run
if you're going to drown,
right.
Hopefully it's not to that level, but you won't be able to mine the resources thereafter. Yeah. The motor has experienced spurious trips, so you don't want that to happen. Spurious trips they're very difficult to plan for, and it disrupts operations.
Nuisance tripping, some people call it.
Yeah, nuisance, spurious tripping. It has some people call it even worse than that.
Yeah, they call it a lot of adjectives.
To explain what's going on here.
Yes.
You need 3 weeks to replace the motor. All right, so this isn't something that you can go into lightly when you have when you're proposing 3 weeks of a potential shutdown.
You don't want to be guessing.
You want to Easter egg this. You want to have a known source of information before you make your decision. How would you troubleshoot this motor online? What would you do? What are some of the tests that you would go through?
Well, given this being a pump, hopefully they can manipulate the operation of it and do what I always suggest is an inrush startup test, right? Now,
maybe not for inrush though, but for if it's running.
Absolutely, because even if it's already running, you can hook it up, do that, look at the RMS envelope, and see what kind of torsional changes, what kind of variations we're seeing for normal load. Pumps are centrifugal pumps, right? So in this situation, sometimes there are positive displacement pumps, but rarely in an industrial setting like this do they need a positive displacement pump. So with a centrifugal pump, you don't expect a lot of load variations. It should be a relatively smooth variation, but if it starts to change dramatically.
If we're looking at amperage swings,
right,
that's a problem.
Absolutely.
What else?
So that's number one. Of course, because we're on the rotor fault zone, current signature analysis is always a tool that we want to look at. We want to look at the amplitude of that pole pass frequency sideband to the line frequency. Industry recommendations, if pole pass frequency sideband is elevated to within 36 dB of the line frequency, you've got a problem, mm-hmm. right? So, if it's down around 45 or more of a
you may have multiple problems in that motor.
You could have multiple problems, absolutely. So the current signature analysis, look at that pole pass frequency is important. We also like to look at the fifth harmonic, right? And as long as it's a four pole, six pole or higher, again, we're kind of ignoring the two pole motors here for that fifth harmonic. But the fifth harmonic basically is a great indication and another solidifying variable that says, hey, there's an inversion in the magnetic flux at a certain point in the rotor that shouldn't be happening. When a bar breaks, you've got basically a 180-degree phase shift in the magnetic field that's generated from that rotor. When that happens, it shows up as a pole pass frequency sideband around the fifth harmonic. In fact, three, right? So if you see those subharmonics or those lower sidebands around that fifth harmonic, what is the fifth for a standard, North American 60 hertz, it'd be 300 hertz, right?
Or 250 if you're
right. If you're in a 50 hertz environment, 250. Right. But those three sidebands to the lower side of that fifth harmonic is a very telling indicator. If you've got elevated pole pass frequency, allow line frequency, but no fifth harmonic, our tech support is going to tell you to keep running that motor. They really want to see that. Now this is again four pole or higher. Two-pole motors have a natural, we call it a swirl effect. Actually, it's not, we didn't name it. A well-known engineer from GE was the one that sort of tagged that line. But a swirl effect or the fifth harmonic analysis is a very good tool.
What about speed? Can we trend speed? Will we see changes?
You mentioned this earlier. Speed is absolutely a telling indication. And again, it's a little bit hard to understand it verbally. But if anyone's seen the speed torque curve, okay, as you speed up, the torque drops, right? in a motor. You know, it starts out, it goes through the pull-out torque, and once it speeds up, the torque drops.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you simply just lower the speed of a motor, you increase the torque.
Right.
Well, it happens naturally with a broken bar. The motor will slow down to still provide the load what the load is asking for. So a drop in the speed is a big deal. If the nameplate of that speed is 1780, and you go out there with a strobe or measure it with an Emax or something, and now the speed at full load is 1730, there's a problem.
That could be a big problem.
Absolutely.
What about like motors? We always preach this when we're doing troubleshooting. Do you have a motor to compare it to?
It's the old Sesame Street problem, right? Street. Which one of these is not like
one of these
the other?
Is not like the
That's
other.
The way it goes.
Oh, my goodness.
So that is an absolute tool. You know, if you've got, you know, this is extremely common in DC motors, right? Because most people who have DC motors have two, or they have three, just like it. Doesn't always happen in an AC induction world, but if you have a motor, another motor like it, or an identical motor, you've got a very good tool for comparison. If two motors doing the same thing at the same load and one's turning 10 or 20 RPM lower, man, that's a telltale sign, yeah. Right? So absolutely, comparisons is an absolute tool.
What about, so vibration data? We couldn't take any vibration data in this case. You would recommend vibration data, but you can't get to it.
Absolutely, it's a ladder indicator. When I say ladder, I mean it's going to be later in the stage of failure before vibration starts to really be a dominant indicator.
Okay.
But it's still a great correlating tool, and yes, absolutely, we like to see.
In this case, that we didn't see any. So, all of the steps that you just described were taken with respect to this motor, and all the signs were we have elevated pole pass sidebands, we had fifth harmonic activity, we had current oscillations, and the inrush startup. Process analysis tool. And so the decision was made that, listen, we've got to pull this motor. It's too many spurious trips or nuisance trips. So it was time to pull it and
shut it down, do some offline testing. Absolutely.
Right. And what we found were 9 broken bars.
Dang, that's a lot.
Inside that motor. And one was just millimeters away from a very close component. We just talked about this fault zone.
That would be the stator.
Yeah, so air gaps nowadays are very tight specs. In the past, you used to see a pretty wide gap between the rotor and the stator, but they've really shrunk those down. So
absolutely.
Any minor fault where a rotor bar comes out.
And you bring up a good point with the whole distance to the stator and the rotor, because the design of the rotor becomes a big deal, right?
Yeah.
So if you think about, you know, every time your motor goes to the shop, one of the things you want to do is add to the birth certificate, as we like to call it, how many bars. That's a key piece of information. What is the bar design, right? Because if you think about a rotor, it can be either closed bar or open bar design. And if by that I mean if you simply look at a rotor and you can't see the rotor bars, it's a closed bar design. The rotor bars are inside the steel laminations and they're not at the surface. But if it's an open bar design, you can actually see the bar running through the steel laminations. Well, just like you mentioned, if that bar breaks and starts to squeeze out of that slot, it has a tendency to cause secondary damage, flies into the stator. Now you've doubled your damage and doubled your cost at least.
So what are some operating procedures with broken bars, right? Because we said it's a 3-week, maybe we didn't have a replacement in place just yet. So what about the situation where this is a critical motor, but it has to be remanufactured, it's going to take 6 months to get here? Tell me procedures with broken bars.
Well, earlier we said the most stressful time of a motor is during the startup,
right?
So for sure, if you can minimize the starts and stops, you minimize that severe thermal expansion and stress on a motor. Once it's up and running and delivering load, even though if it's a broken bar, you're going to see oscillations, but you don't have that huge stress that you get on startup. So minimize startups as much as possible.
I always hear people say minimize load fluctuations. That's hard to do, is it?
It's almost impossible.
Yeah.
But if you can, you would want to do it. So in other words, a lot of times if you have a dual motor process where one motor is sort of taking the load and the other one's sort of, you know, filling in the gaps, you'd rather this one be steady eddy. You don't want it to be the one that's changing to satisfy a varying demand. So if possible, it makes sense to try.
Yeah.
Increase the monitoring frequency would make sense. I mean, you know, how quickly is this going bad? You know, we do have standards that we follow as far as the dB differential down. You know, see how quickly that's changing. It might, you know, raise or lower the severity and the need to take action.
You could almost put band alarms around the pole pass frequency and then just kind of measure how is it changing over time.
Absolutely.
Because you had mentioned 34 dB or something
36,
like 36 dB.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before it gets to 36, it's starting somewhere, so you can trend that.
And it shouldn't be, you know, operations complaining about this performance or someone saying that motor is having a hard time start up. You should have these band alarms set. You should have them so at some point when that value turns yellow, it's telling you something. The pole pass amplitude has changed to a point where now it's higher than it used to be. Let's go ahead and flag it. Now we can increase frequency. We could have possibly got this thing fixed long before we got into a situation where now we're up against the production demands. You know, right. So.
Or before the bar falls out and
worst case
interacts
scenario.
With the stator.
Right.
So what about, which kind of rolls right into know the rotor design, right? This
Absolutely.
Is where you develop that relationship with the motor shop. To kind of say, well, what do I have? How many bars do I have?
Exactly.
And what's the design of that rotor?
Well, and a lot of people say, well, why does a bar come out? Well, again, in an open bar design, what happens is when you break that bar, we like to say current finds a way, right? Current is going to find a way to flow, and unfortunately it flows through the lamination tips. So right where the bar runs through that open slot, the tips of lamination start to burn up and open that slot up. It literally almost burns open. And with the excessive heat, expansion, now you have the ability for that bar to fly out. And if it's a two-pole motor, high centrifugal forces, it doesn't take a lot to throw that rotor bar out.
Okay, so thank you for all the information that you've delivered to us for this podcast on rotors. As we mentioned, we went through all the different faults that can happen, or what types of problems can happen with the rotor. How do we test it offline and online? You helped guide us through a pretty complicated case study with a critical asset to keep that water table low. So as always, we thank you for your expertise and what you bring to the table, Noah.
Happy to be here.
And once again, we're happy that we were able to impart some knowledge on you. And next time, we're getting into our last but not least fault zone, which would be
final fault zone.
The final frontier. Air gap, so we hope that you tune in for that. Once again, we thank you for listening to us, and we hope that you learned something today that can help you make a better tomorrow. Until then, till we hear from you next time, you guys stay safe, and we'll talk to you real soon.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Todd and Noah Show. We'll be back for another episode very soon. In between, we hope to see you in the Mobius Connect online community, where you can network, learn, and share with Todd and Noah and other industry professionals at mobiusconnect.com, and we will see you there soon.